Welcome to this special Journal Club edition of Prostate Cancer Update. This is medical oncologist Dr. Neil Love. We gathered an interdisciplinary faculty of Drs. Peter Carroll, Anthony D'Amico, and William O. to discuss some of the most important journal publications and meeting presentations in the last year. And to begin, Dr. Carroll discusses a paper presented at the oral session of the GU Cancer Symposium, a fascinating study by Stephenson et al., looking at prostate cancer mortality after radical prostatectomy in the PSA era.
These investigators looked at the long-term risk of prostate cancer mortality after radical prostatectomy in a very large cohort, a modeling cohort of over approximately 6,400 patients and a validation cohort of around 4,000 patients. And I think, interestingly and not surprisingly, the long-term risk of prostate cancer-specific mortality was actually quite low over the entire series, and this varied anywhere from 2% in good-risk patients, which constituted roughly half the patients, to as high as 19%. And again, this is at 15 years for high-risk patients, which constituted only about 20% of the entire sample. So for me, I think what this tells me is, number one, long-term risk of prostate cancer mortality is quite low after radical prostatectomy, certainly in contemporary series. Now, what's interesting to me is that this favorable prognosis may be a product of certainly the intervention, the surgery, or it may be a product of, in fact, taking very relatively low-risk patients, or the favorable feature patient we've seen develop because of the aggressive screening practice in the United States. And I thought what was very interesting here is they looked at the impact of treatment year on outcome and found that treatment year was a very important predictor of prostate cancer-specific mortality. Now, one could say, is that because we've become better surgeons over time? Is there been changes in grading over time, so there's less undergrading? Or could it be a product of the rather significant stage migration or risk group migration that has occurred over the last 15 or 20 years?
What's your take on what it is?
My sense is a lot of this is due to the stage and grade migration over time. You know, we have an increasingly aggressive screening paradigm in the United States where we, number one, started to use PSA. Two, we started to do more biopsies. We want sextant biopsy. Three, we're lowering PSA cut points now from 4 to 2.5 to 2. We're looking at PSA velocity at low cut points. And now we're going from 6 biopsies to 12, 16, or 18 biopsies. And all of these things lead to detecting smaller volume tumors. So this issue of risk migration, even within risk groups, has been rather profound. So the low-risk patient of today, the low-grade T1C, T2A, PSA less than 10 patient today is actually lower risk based on tumor volume than they were 10 or 15 years ago. So I think, in my opinion, as a surgeon, we've become better over time. But I think, importantly, we're working with a disease which is different today at presentation than it was 15 or 20 years ago. Now, after having said that, that doesn't mean that we're not seeing some high-risk patients. We are seeing high-risk patients. Men still die of disease. And in my opinion, the paradigm for prostate cancer will change where we'll start to concentrate more on the high-risk patient. And for the low-risk patient, we may consider surveillance in lieu of active treatment, but for the high-risk patient, more active and more innovative treatment.
Anthony, what was your take on these data?
I think that studies like this are important for the main issue of patient selection. If we know these are the predictors that are going to lead to a short interval to distant metastatic disease after radical prostatectomy, then we may have managed these people differently up front. And the answer is we don't know exactly what the management should differ by, but at least these could be the selection factors for clinical trials for the future. And perhaps the clinical parameters suggested in this paper will make us more intelligent about how to select high-risk patients for future trials aimed at abrogating micrometastatic disease.
What is the time course of recurrence in prostate cancer in the PSA era? In breast cancer, what's come out is that the ER-positive patients have a very high risk of cancer progression in years 5 to 15. Now, what do we know about prostate cancer? Obviously, it was going to differ in terms of, I guess, the risk group, in terms of what the risk of delayed PSA progression is. What is it at 2 years? What is it at 5 years? What is it 10 years? What do you say to your patients
when they get to the 2, 5, and 10 year point, still have undetectable PSA in terms of the risk of delayed PSA progression.
It depends upon the factors at baseline. If you look at a person who has high risk features, particularly the high grade cancers, the 8 to 10s, you'll see after just monotherapy with surgery or with radiation that approximately 1/3 to 1/2 of men will recur within the first 5 years.
Now, for example, how many would recur in years 5 to 10?
So actually, that's a good point. What happens as the patient becomes more favorable, the probability of a late recurrence actually goes up. So low-risk patients rarely fail within the first decade. If you see failures there, they fail usually after a decade, and that might be somewhere between 5 and 10%. The clinical relevance of those late recurrences, though, is uncertain. Intermediate to high-risk patients tend to fail earlier, within the first 5 to 10 years. After that, the actual recurrence rates for high-risk drop off because most of them have already happened. So I guess the general principle is the higher the risk, the shorter the time to recurrence. And if you are a high-risk patient, if you had a Gleason 8 PSA 15 cancer and you were treated, let's say, with surgery and your PSA is undetectable 10 years out, you probably are cured or you're probably very unlikely to recur. But that's not true in terms of if you were a low-risk patient where recurrence rates can still occur, although the clinical relevance of them is uncertain.
Let's move on to this paper from the JCO, Anthony, that I asked you to talk about, the 10-year follow-up of RTOG-9202.
So this is the long-term follow-up of a randomized trial of about 1,500 men, all who had high-risk, locally advanced prostate cancer, who were randomized to radiation therapy and 4 months of hormonal therapy, 2 before radiation, 2 during, to that treatment plus an additional 2 years of an LHRH agonist alone. Similar to the earlier reporting of this study, what it found was that for the overall trial, there was a decrease in cancer-specific death, metastases, local progression, and PSA progression in people who received the additional 2 years of the LHRH agonist. But in the overall study, as similar to the prior report, they could not show a difference in overall survival. The exact numbers were about a 7% improvement in cancer-specific death and about a 2% improvement in overall survival. But when you look at the curve, the overall survival curve overlaps. They performed a subgroup analysis, as they had in the earlier report, of men with Gleason score 8 to 10 cancers. And I think that the conclusion sentence of their abstract accurately reflects what one can conclude from this study, and that is that the survival advantage in the treatment of locally advanced tumors with Gleason 8 to 10 suggests, I underline the word suggests, that this should be the standard of treatment for these high-risk patients. And I think the word suggests is correct because a subgroup analysis of a large randomized trial is hypothesis generating. And so I know that based on this study, as well as the original study from the EORTC, our standard of care in this country is to give long-term hormonal therapy, at least 2 years, to men with locally advanced and high-grade disease, and I think that that's reasonable, although I think it remains unanswered as to whether or not, given the lack of survival benefit in this study for overall patients, whether or not there is a role for shorter-term hormonal therapy in some men with high-risk disease, particularly, as we'll get to in a moment, that hormonal therapy is not without risk of other sorts as men age or in men with significant comorbidities.
William, what did you think about this paper?
I think there may be a time issue where a survival benefit hasn't been seen yet simply because the patients haven't been followed long enough given the mixture of Gleason scores in the overall group. I do think that getting to the endpoint issue, although there's no overall survival benefit except in the high Gleason score tumors, it's really all of the other endpoints, disease-free survival, distant metastasis, disease-specific survival, local progression, biochemical failure, very compelling, I think, that suggests that in patients with locally advanced disease, really irrespective of their Gleason score, that there's a likely benefit to longer-term hormonal therapy.
The question I would ask Anthony, what about the patient with a high-grade but low T-stage, low PSA cancer? Does this data suggest that those patients should get long-term hormonal therapy, or do you treat those patients differently compared to what's been advised here?
That's an excellent question, Peter. So the patient selection criteria for 9202 is exactly what you said. They are mostly high grade, high volume, and high stage. Specifically, when you look, you know, at the patient selection, more than two-thirds of the patients were T3, T4s, and, you know, another 20% were Gleason 8 to 10, and about 40% Gleason 7. And it was also, you know, these people were accrued between 1992 and 1997, so it was in the very early PSA era. So today, you know, when we look at the randomized trial data, what randomized trial data exists that get at the T1C, T2A, Gleason 8 patients, you know, who have less than half the course positive? And the answer to that is the only place where those patients exist in any reasonable number are in the studies that looked at short-term hormonal therapy, the Australian study by Jim Denham and our own study, which we'll discuss shortly. And these studies were not exclusively those patients. The Australian study had 40% T3-4, so about half the patients in that study were high-grade, localized. In our own study, we had intermediate-risk patients as well, so we only had about 30% of the kind of patients we're talking about here with high-grade, localized. So there is no single study that looks specifically at high-grade, localized to answer the question. To get at what I do, I take comorbidity into account a lot more than I did at one point. And now if I have a guy who's got a high-grade cancer that's localized and has any comorbid illness or is at advancing age, I favor short course as opposed to long course hormonal therapy for the reasons we'll get to shortly in terms of the randomized trial data that exist in that setting.
Let's bring in the paper that was published in June 20th of the JCO, Anthony, that you were the first author on, looking at the risk of prostate cancer recurrence in your trial.
So this study, I want to start out, the first statement I want to make is it's hypothesis generating because it's a post-randomization analysis, and the endpoint is not cancer death or overall survival, it's recurrence-free or PSA recurrence-free survival. So I think the study is interesting, but that's the category I'd put it in right now. Having said that, what it says is that in men who were on this randomized trial in which 6 months of hormonal therapy combined either Lupron or Zoladex with flutamide, which was the antiandrogen we had at that point, was prescribed, in those men who were randomized to the 6 months of hormonal therapy and radiation, about a quarter of them had to come off the flutamide early, mostly because their LFTs became elevated. And what we're able to do is we're able to look in a post-randomization analysis at the outcome of people who got all 6 months of combined hormonal blockade versus those who got 6 months of the LHRH agonist and less than 6 months of the antiandrogen, and found that recurrence-free survival was best in the guys who got all 6 months of both, the worst in the guys who got radiation alone, and intermediate in the guys who got 6 months of the LHRH agonist and less than 6 months of the antiandrogen. So what does this say? It suggests, it does not prove, that perhaps if you're going to use a short course of hormonal therapy, you want to use combined. But, you know, there's several leaps of faith here. One, the endpoint of the study is progression-free survival, not cancer-specific death and overall survival. And two, only really a randomized trial can really answer this question. Good news is that the Japanese are running a trial that may help in answering this question. They're taking people who are unfit for surgery or radiation who have localized prostate cancer or locally advanced, and randomizing them to combined hormonal blockade versus LHRH alone. There is some preliminary information on this study that suggests that, in fact, the combined group is doing better in terms of distant disease-free survival, which is a reasonable endpoint, although that's only been in an abstract and not a final paper form. So the takeaway message, if anything, from this study is that there's some evidence to suggest, not prove, but to suggest that combined as opposed to LHRH alone may be the way to go if you're going to use a short course of hormonal therapy in men treated with radiation for high-risk cancer.
William, any comments?
I think this was a very interesting result. When I first saw this, it was a surprising result given where we've come with the value of combined androgen blockade in the setting of metastatic disease, namely that it has a very modest effect overall at 10-year survival in metastatic patients. I do think that one of the questions that comes up when you look at these two papers together is whether or not some of the benefit of the addition of the antiandrogen would have been abrogated by a longer course of LHRH agonist, something that obviously it's not being asked in this study, but you know, would a longer duration of LHRH agonist have overcome this effect? The other is the use of flutamide, which we rarely use now compared to bicalutamide, which is less likely to cause liver toxicity. I think that it does bring up the question that at least clinically it's probably less of an issue that patients would stop an antiandrogen because of liver toxicity nowadays with a typical combined androgen blockade regimen.
Before I get Peter's take on this, Anthony, why don't you bring in your JAMA paper looking at androgen suppression and radiation versus radiation alone?
Right. So we had the updated results of the randomized trial of radiation alone or radiation in 6 months of combined hormonal blockade, two before, two during, and two after radiation, with a median follow-up of about 7.5 years, was published this past year. What it showed was that there continues to be an overall survival benefit in men who receive the 6 months of hormonal therapy in addition to radiation. And just to recap, the kinds of patients that were in this study, about 15% were 8 to 10, about half of the men were Gleason 7s, and they were all T1 or T2, up to T2B. So they were localized, and about two-thirds had Gleason 7 to 10 disease, of which approximately 20% were Gleason 8 to 10. So the survival benefit was maintained. It was actually strengthened. The hazard ratio maintained itself at about 2, which means that you drop the overall death rate in half by giving these men hormonal therapy. But there was an additional analysis that was performed, which was post-randomization, but I think interesting. And it was based on going back to randomization and quantifying a comorbidity index on each gentleman, something called the ACE-27. And it's an index that's been validated for people who have cancer. And what this index showed is that when we looked at the results of the study in the men who had no or minimal comorbidity using this index, the survival benefit in the guys who got the combined hormonal therapy of 6 months duration and radiation was enhanced, which kind of makes sense because if you take the healthier group and you ask, if you give a more effective treatment, how do they do? Well, they're going to do even better because they don't have other things competing for their life. However, the striking finding was that in the subgroup of men who had moderate or severe comorbidity, which was most often scored because they had had a prior heart attack within the last 6 months to 2 years, that in fact, there was no survival benefit in that group who received the hormonal therapy and radiation as compared to radiation. And if anything, the survival was going in the reverse direction. While not significant, the p-value was 0.08, it appeared there was a lower survival in men with moderate or severe comorbidity who got radiation and hormones, raising the question that, in fact, are we doing more harm than good in treating men with significant comorbidities, particularly cardiovascular, with hormonal therapy, despite the fact that they have high-risk disease. The last point I'll make is that this is a post-randomization analysis. And while the endpoint is overall survival, which is a good endpoint, it's still hypothesis generating. And as the journal correctly states, and as we put into the conclusion, this interaction between level of comorbidity and hormonal therapy and its impact on survival really requires formal assessment in a prospective study in which men are first stratified by comorbidity and then randomized. But what this study has done for me, or this analysis has done for me, is it's raised my awareness to the possibility that, in fact, we may have to think more carefully about hormonal therapy in men who've had prior cardiac or currently existing cardiac disease.
Peter, what's your take on this paper as well as the two we discussed before?
Well, Anthony gets my award for asking interesting questions and data analysis. And these are two issues that have actually gone by the wayside for most practitioners. In this country, about half the hormonal use is using an LHRH agonist alone and half combined therapy. And as we all know, this was an intense issue probably about a decade ago and kind of fallen by the wayside. And he raises it again here. And I agree that we need to look at this all over again in a lower risk cohort as he did here. Also, the same thing with the comorbidity. There's been a blind uptake of hormonal therapy frequently for prolonged periods in use with radiation therapy. And again, what this article suggests is we should relook at that and recognize that comorbidity and age may be important predictors of outcome and perhaps responsiveness to hormonal therapy. So again, I think we need to, on both issues, step back a bit, relook at them, study them prospectively, and come to a more clear and firm estimate of risk and benefit.
Anthony, maybe you can talk a little bit about this paper that Mac Roach was the first author on in February in the JCO, looking at short-term neoadjuvant androgen deprivation therapy and external beam for locally advanced disease, RTOG 8610.
So this study fascinates me for a number of reasons. So this is a randomized study done in the pre-PSA era, accrued between 87 and 91, of 456 men randomized to radiation alone or radiation and 4 months of hormonal therapy, two before and two during, and it was combined hormonal blockade. Of all the randomized studies we have discussed in men with localized or locally advanced prostate cancer, this one has the most unfavorable patients, because in this one, you're in the earliest part of the PSA era or pre-PSA. So these patients were diagnosed predominantly, if not exclusively, based on digital rectal exam. In fact, when you look in the table of the pretreatment characteristics, they have the stages listed as B2 and C, which is our old staging system before PSA. Despite the very advanced nature of these patients, with only 4 months of hormonal therapy, there was a cancer-specific survival benefit seen in the overall study. And I find that remarkable. There was not an overall survival benefit seen. However, when you actually look at the numbers, the difference in overall survival in this study, while not significant, was no different than the difference in 9202, where you looked at long versus short course hormonal therapy in patients that were slightly more favorable than these. And so I think this paper speaks to the power of a short course of hormonal therapy, even in very advanced patients. Now, a second analysis that they did was looking at time to fatal cardiac events. And while they were able to show that there was a numerical increase in these events in guys who were randomized to the hormones and radiation compared to radiation, they were not able to show a significant increase. However, I have a caveat to put here. This study looked at the overall effect of hormonal therapy on cardiovascular death and did not stratify men by baseline comorbidity. The mere fact that there was a numerical increase suggests to me that if they had the ability to look by comorbidity subgroup, they may find exactly what we found in the six-month study, and that is men with moderate to severe comorbidity may be more predisposed to the fatal cardiac events. But that wasn't done here. So I think that we have to be careful when we read the conclusion statement of the abstract that says there was no statistically significant impact on the risk of fatal cardiac events, with the caveat that this was not stratified by pre-randomization comorbidity.
Anthony, you know, since you brought up this issue of comorbidities or other impacts of androgen deprivation, maybe you can talk a little bit about this paper from the ASCO meeting looking at the impact of androgen deprivation on bone, cardiovascular, and endocrine outcomes. Can you talk about that study?
Right. So very interesting data set, very important data set. I have some issues with how it was analyzed that I brought up at the meeting, and I'll highlight here. So this is a cross-sectional or observational study analysis of men 66 or older who lived in the province of Ontario in Canada. It has a very large cohort, almost 20,000 men, and what they did was they looked at the outcomes of hormonal therapy use on bone, cardiovascular, and endocrine health. What they found was that in men who used hormonal therapy for at least 6 months and who were 66 or older, that the use of hormonal therapy was associated with an increased risk of bone fracture, which has been published before, and diabetes, which has been noted by Matthew Smith, but not acute MI or hypercholesterolemia. Now, there's two logistical issues here. One is sort of a technical note, and that is the analysis they used was Cox regression, and they really should use a competing risks analysis because the endpoints they're looking at are not exclusive of one another. But there's a much more important issue here, and this is something that's in press that I'll just allude to, and that's this. They did not control in their analysis for people who had received prior treatment. So included in this study were men who were on androgen deprivation therapy for metastatic disease, or people who have had prior prostatectomy or radiation and hormones failed and then went on hormonal therapy for a rising PSA. And the reason why that's so important is because as the risk of cancer death goes up, i.e. a guy who's metastatic as a guy who's newly diagnosed, let's say, with high-risk disease, the ability to see an impact of hormonal therapy on cardiovascular death lessens because the risk of cancer death is increasing in the guys with metastatic disease, let's say, as opposed to newly diagnosed disease. So I asked them at the meeting to go back and to adjust for this since they have the information on prior treatment. What they really should do is make this assessment in people who are newly diagnosed and not people necessarily who are metastatic or rising PSA after failed prostatectomy or radiation. I say this also because we have data right now that's in press that gets at this point exactly. And we did exactly that study where we looked at the risk of cardiovascular death and hormonal therapy use in men who were diagnosed de novo versus those who were treated with hormonal therapy after failed radiation and hormones, where they had a rising PSA. And we could not find a significant difference in cardiovascular events in men who got hormonal therapy out back for failure as opposed to up front for newly diagnosed disease. So I think that the next level of sophistication here is that hormonal therapy use may very well be necessary and indicated as the prostate cancer disease increases, aggressiveness increases to recurrence and metastatic. So I think this analysis is important. I think it needs to be redone with the caveat I just made about adjusting for prior therapy.
Peter, how do you take these data and a lot other out there and put it into a practical construct in terms of following someone on androgen deprivation therapy? Do you need to get bone densities? How often? Cholesterol, et cetera, et cetera? And also relative contraindications?
Well, we, like others, would risk adjust the likelihood of an adverse event based on comorbidity and age. So there are certain patients who's going to suffer more than others, and I think you can select them based on lifestyle, age, and comorbidity, and also to the extent how long you plan to keep them on hormonal therapy. Short-term is different than long-term. So we would determine risk based on those features and then screen men based on their individual profile. Here we're talking about bone, cardiovascular, endocrine outcomes, but there are many others that are not looked at here. Cognitive decline, other quality of life endpoints, which are not routinely measured, and when they are, there are adverse effects in those domains as well.
Let's bring in the last paper sort of related to this, Anthony, which is an oral presentation from the AUA looking at the high prevalence of metabolic syndrome in patients on ADT.
So while it's a small study with only 54 men, I think it's an important study, and I'd like to see this study reproduced in a larger number of patients. But the bottom line is that in men undergoing hormonal therapy for metastatic prostate cancer or locally advanced, they were able to show that the extent to which the metabolic consequences were seen increased as you went from short-term hormonal therapy to long-term. What you see is that the probability of increasing your blood pressure, having a high blood glucose, dropping your HDL, or increasing your body mass index all increases as you go from a short course of hormonal therapy to a longer course of hormonal therapy. And so I think that the study's small, and I think, it needs to be validated in larger people. The way I would do the next study is I'd have a larger group. I'd not only look at just these endpoints we just mentioned, but I'd look at it by age. In this study, the population average was 72. And clearly, as men age, the impact of any amount of hormonal therapy increases because we know that the duration of testosterone suppression following a fixed amount of hormonal therapy in a given individual will increase with age. Said another way, if you give a guy 6 months of hormonal therapy when he's 50 versus when he's 75, the impact at 75 in terms of testosterone suppression is much more than when he's 50. So I would suspect, although it's not proven yet, that the metabolic consequences of a given amount of hormonal therapy probably increase with age. So I think the study is important. It sets the stage for the next study, which is how much worse is long-term than short-term as men age.
Just getting back to bone, though, Anthony, what's your practical approach in terms of bone density monitoring? Do you do that up front? In what situations? How often you do it? Bisphosphonates?
Right. So I think that the standard of practice is if you're going to have somebody on long-term hormonal therapy defined as more than 1 year, you get a baseline bone mineral density, and then it's repeated on an annual basis. Vitamin D and calcium, I believe, are used routinely for anybody who has any evidence of bone density below what he should have for his age. But if at any point you drop below 2.5 standard deviations below the average bone density for your age, that's when a bisphosphonate is recommended.
Peter, can you talk a little bit about the work that was presented at ASCO and then published recently in the JCO, along with an editorial by Eric Klein, looking at the so-called systems approach to evaluating prognosis in prostate cancer?
I think this is a novel approach. I do want to point out, though, before commenting, is that if we look at risk assessment tools as they exist today, the concordance indices, that means the likelihood that the prediction is true, If you look at Parden tables, CAPRA scores, CATAN, if you look at all these together, these indices generally range between 0.68 to 0.85. So that's telling us we're doing a pretty good job right now looking at standard clinical pathologic features and predicting outcome.
And when you say, for example, 0.65, what does that mean?
That means that if you take your prediction and look at the actual outcome, you're right 68% of the time. It's called concordance index, and it's a very nice way for people to understand how well these tools actually do. So again, between 68 to 85% of the time, the tool, whichever tool you use, predicts the outcome accurately. So if you take that as a baseline, we don't have to go too far to come up with an even more accurate overall prediction. If we're starting out 70% accurate, adding molecular markers, phenotypic markers can get us, hopefully, to a more precise estimate of outcome, and that's what we're highlighting here. One of them is called systems pathology, which is a technique where you're trying to preserve the architectural and spatial patterns and relationships between tissues and cells as you analyze it. So what this group does is they take PSA and Gleason score, and they take the tissue from needle biopsy specimens and stain it with seven different antibody stains and come up with a prediction tool to improve the estimate of the outcome. And this is one example, but there will be many others, and many genotypic and phenotypic markers which will be added to standard clinical pathologic features to predict outcome. This is one novel way to do it, and it works well on paraffin-embedded needle biopsy specimens, which obviously is an important requirement if we're going to use prediction tools early on in the course of a treatment. We don't want something that requires whole prostatectomy specimens or fresh tissue. We'd like to do it in paraffin-embedded needle biopsy specimens, and that's what I think is especially important about this. It's novel technology, but it actually works on paraffin-embedded biopsy specimens, which are routinely available.
I first heard about this from Peter Scardino, who's one of the, I guess, collaborators on this project, sort of an interesting, I guess, industry, academic, you know, partnership. And it was interesting the way it seemed like they were kind of trying to use computer, you know, artificial intelligence to try to take these different factors and analyze. Again, it almost, even though it wasn't looking at RT-PCR, it reminded me a little bit about the way they approached it with Oncotype. Can you talk a little bit more about exactly what they were looking at and sort of how they sort of did this kind of analysis, Peter?
Well, as I understand it, talking to Dr. Cordon Cardo, is what they do is they stain the tissue, and what's important here is they preserve the relationship between different tissue types, the spatial architecture, and they gain information from that. They're also able, based on these algorithms, to map out the benign tissue and actually can highlight the malignant tissue. And you're absolutely right, it is neural-based processing, so the data becomes improved over time. So again, I think it's a very novel form of tissue analysis on tissue that is readily available. Do I think this is the last step? No, I don't think so, because there's likely other markers that could be added to this that will improve things. And of course, this type of technique needs to be validated on other data sets, large data sets from a variety of institutions or community-based practices until we really know how well this performs overall.
And actually, it seems, I mean, that is the paradigm that it looks like they're following. This data is considered the preoperative training model, I guess, to develop, you know, the algorithm. And then it gets, I guess, would be tested prospectively. I'm curious, William, what you think about this technology and also the way they're approaching trying to validate it, looking at clinical data.
Well, I think that it's not clear that there is any enhancement of prediction of outcome compared with known clinical parameters. And it's not even clear necessarily that this systems method is better than excellent pathologists, very experienced at large centers. Now, that said, I think we have to remember that, you know, we come from institutions which have high volumes of prostatectomies and biopsies and whose pathologists are specialized and really excellent at reading Gleason scores and reading these types of histologic parameters on which so much rides in terms of the prediction of outcome. That really tells me, at least at this point, before getting too fancy with the biomarkers themselves, this type of system could have a great impact in its applicability to the average clinician in the community, where we know, having read multiple second opinion biopsies from all over the country, that there's quite a lot of variability, particularly in centers where they have relatively low volumes of biopsies and prostatectomies for the pathologist to read. So I see the first application of this type of technology really being a way of more standardizing simple tools of Gleason scoring and more accurately and reproducibly, for example, giving a Gleason score. I think later we can look at whether or not it really improves the predictive or prognostic data that you get from a pathology score.
I think it's a really interesting point, Anthony. And again, thinking back to Oncotype, you know, in the past, every breast specimen, the grade, for example, was read at each individual hospital. It was shown repeatedly. It was completely unreliable. Then when people started getting involved with the Oncotype, which was only a specific segment of breast cancer, all the tissue was going to one central lab. And that seemed to have an advantage in terms of trying to standardize some of these issues. What do you think about this particular initiative and this sort of general strategy?
I think the initiative and the strategy is important. But I guess I want to make two points that have been made and just capitalize on them. When I look carefully at the results here, the sensitivity, specificity, et cetera, you know, the actual performance characteristics of this particular model with these molecular tissue type markers, I don't see anything that's strikingly different than what I've seen when we look at simpler models based on PSA, Gleason, T stage, et cetera. However, I think what is unique about this approach is that when you start looking at androgen receptor expression or staining, and you start to look at tissue-based parameters that may have some implication on how a patient may respond to a type of treatment, androgen suppression, for example, other types of systemic-based chemotherapies is another example, that becomes interesting and exciting. I think that the place in which this will have its major role, if at all, is not in improving risk group stratification. We have that already. But this may be used to identify subsets of men with high-grade prostate cancer who are androgen responsive or who are taxotere or satraplatinum, et cetera, responsive. And I think that's where this will help us, hopefully, in the future. And I think the next step is to actually do prospective studies in which you tissue type the patient upfront, put them through a prescribed treatment, assess treatment outcome, and see if in any way that relates to the tissue expression profile you had up front. And the endpoints really have to be much harder than what I see here, this progression-free survival, because that can be influenced so much by the use of hormonal therapy. The endpoints have to be at least time to distant mets or time to cancer death.
What about the idea of trying to apply these kinds of new biomarker studies, Peter, to data sets that are already out there? You already have tissue in patients, whether they're in trials or registries. We actually just had, believe it or not, a 5-hour closed roundtable discussion just on the topic of biomarkers in breast cancer. And we had Richard Simon there from the NCI, and he was talking about the sort of from a statistician's point of view, what the right and wrong way is to go about validating markers. Where do you see prostate cancer heading in this regard, Peter?
Well, my concerns would probably be similar to his. I do think that risk assessment tools could have an impact not only on predicting response, but improving our ability to estimate outcome or prognosis. So again, if we layer on a marker or a test to a concordance index using standard histopathologic features of 75%, and we raise that prediction to 85 or 90%, I still think that's valuable. I agree completely with Anthony that actually looking at an individual marker that predicts response or outcome would be quite nice. Of course, then you'd have to prospectively test that marker. So what you do is you look at the marker and randomize based on the marker to determine whether or not you influence outcome.
Or find a data set that's already out there in a trial where that was done, where you can get the tissue.
Yeah, I think, you know, now there are large tissue repositories held centrally and peripherally in institutions. And I've always thought that it would be unique to develop a prediction sciences consortium of institutions or investigators to assemble these large data sets and then use them to test markers like this, kind of a hypothesis generating idea. And based on that knowledge, you could do a prospective trial.
Getting back to Anthony's point about the specific markers, I noticed one of the things they're looking at is Ki-67, which should be proportional to cell turnover. And in the Oncotype, the proliferation indices were thought to be a big part of why they saw that some of these patients with the high scores, you know, responded well to chemo. And that wasn't maybe the whole story, but it was a big part of the story, as opposed to the lower proliferation indices that didn't respond. Do you see that maybe playing out in prostate cancer, William?
Well, even compared to breast cancer, prostate cancers are remarkably non-proliferative. They're very small populations that are actually Ki-67 positive, which may explain to some extent why we haven't yet seen the dramatic impact, for example, of neoadjuvant chemotherapy in the setting of a newly diagnosed high-grade prostate cancer. But I do think that Ki-67 will turn out to be an important marker. The real question is whether we can hone in on the small population of cells that ultimately are the ones that lead to relapse and death in these patients. That's the problem, again, in prostate cancer, is that it may be a very, very small population that you have to microdissect those cells, because those are the cells hidden amongst, let's say, lower-grade hormone-sensitive cells that may ultimately be the one population of cells that will proliferate and kill the patient. And we, in doing these types of studies well, whether from paraffin or from freshly collected tissue, it's very, very important that you apply the molecular marker to the cells that you want to, that is, that you microdissect and pull out the pieces that really reflect the biology of the underlying tumor.
So, Peter, when I talked to Peter Scardino a few months ago and I heard about this project, I was, you know, just really interesting. The thing that really jumped out is when he started telling me about this stuff about androgen receptor levels, which I hadn't really seen anything like this myself before. And there was a paper that this collaboration presented at the GU symposium looking specifically at androgen receptor levels. Can you comment on that poster?
Well, only to say that, in fact, using a similar technique, they looked at the androgen receptor. And again, reactivation of AR responsiveness pathway is one mechanism by which tumors can become resistant to androgen deprivation therapy. So it makes biological sense to look at this. And again, they showed using similar techniques that in fact AR levels in either the biopsy or radical prostatectomy specimen appear to be prognostic for castration-resistant metastatic disease. So again, it's taking biology and trying to use that information to develop a prognostic tool, and it appears that in fact they have something that might be quite predictive.
Anthony, what do you think sort of the biologic message might be that's coming out of this stuff looking at androgen receptor levels?
Well, I look at the bottom line result, which is a hazard ratio of 0.36 for androgen receptor expression associated with survival. So what it says is that as the intensity of androgen receptor goes up, or you have more androgen receptor, your probability of death goes down. I guess what it's saying is that you're still androgen responsive. And so perhaps the biological message we'll talk about maybe a little bit later is more effective elimination of androgen. And there may be ways to do that even beyond maximal hormonal blockade. I think the other message here might also be that there may be, as Peter had mentioned the model before, a way to take a pre-existing database in which men have been randomized to androgen deprivation versus not, stain them up front for this androgen receptor tissue marker, and see if, in fact, their survival was related in the guys who got the androgen suppression to the androgen receptor density up front. If it was, then that would be a way one could prospectively assess treatment in a newly diagnosed patient. That is, if they had a high level of androgen receptor expression, then they may get more out of hormonal therapy as opposed to somebody who has a lower level of expression.
Although these were patients with, quote, castration-resistant disease, correct?
Right, but we also know that people with castrate-resistant disease still express androgen receptor and, in fact, may still be responsive to treatment if you can get the intraprostatic or the area where the cancer is, those levels to the appropriate degree.
William, I'm not sure what the message is coming out of this. It may be that if we could get other agents, these patients might have tumors that would respond to a secondary hormonal therapy.
We do actually know and have known for years that there are some patients who will respond to a series of hormonal therapies, both primary LHRH agonists, orchiectomy, followed by anti-androgens, adrenal steroid inhibitors, estrogens, and that there are some patients who really fly by all of those and progress very rapidly to castrate-resistant disease. I do think it's interesting the kind of biology of AR. The reason we have not traditionally stained for AR in primary specimens the way you do in breast cancer is that almost all of these tumors express AR, at least using typical immunohistochemical type tests. That's why this type of systems pathology, where you can really get in and perhaps quantitate AR in an easily accessible test, might give you the additional information, both about prognosis, but as Anthony's really pointed out, really about prediction. Now, that said, the question is, would that test prevent you or not prevent you from putting somebody on hormonal therapy? The answer is, at this point, you're going to put everyone on hormonal therapy whom you think they may benefit from it. But I think it really is about whether or not you'll try secondary or third line hormonal therapies versus going straight to chemotherapy or designing trials around their AR profile.
Just to close out on this topic, because I'm just kind of trying to sort this thing through and just and kind of get a feel for what you think in terms of where this might be headed. Peter, what are your thoughts? Do you think that this kind of concept has a future, or is it really sort of spinning our wheels and going in the wrong direction?
No, I think it has a future. I think what we want to look at, as mentioned by others, is look at the biology and use our understanding of biology to develop not only more accurate risk assessment tools, but novel targets and agents.
I want to ask you, William, about this paper that was presented at ASCO by Figg et al., looking at thalidomide in non-metastatic prostate cancer. We've seen really a striking impact of the so-called IMIDs, thalidomide and lenalidomide, in the hematologic malignancies, particularly multiple myeloma. And I was really struck by seeing this paper in prostate cancer. Can you go through that?
Yeah, the group at the NCI has been interested in thalidomide potentially as an angiogenesis inhibitor. And there actually have been several studies now done in hormone refractory disease or castrate-resistant prostate cancer suggesting that there are PSA responses and potentially an intriguing possibility of an improvement in survival. So what they did as a follow-up to that study was they took low-dose thalidomide and they brought it into the hormone setting. That is, patients who had newly diagnosed advanced prostate cancer, they didn't have to have metastatic disease, but they had to have gone on an LHRH agonist for 6 months. And after the six-month period, they were then randomized to either thalidomide or placebo during what they called oral phase A. And at the time of progression, either PSA that hit 5 or where they started at baseline, they were then redosed with Lupron for another 6 months. And at the end of that period, again, redosed with either placebo or thalidomide, but with a crossover, so-called oral phase B. And what was interesting about this study was with 159 patients that they put on this trial, there was a suggestion in the first phase, the oral phase A, that there was a trend towards a delay in progression in the group that got thalidomide. It was 15 versus 9.6 months, although the p-value was not significant at 0.21. But in the group that then subsequently got oral phase B thalidomide, that was the group that originally got placebo after the first round of Lupron, then after the second round of Lupron got thalidomide. In that group, the group that got thalidomide in the second round had a 17.1-month time to progression versus a 6.6-month time to progression in the placebo group there. The p-value was highly significant, 0.0002, and really a suggestion that thalidomide somehow delayed PSA progression in this group. They did look at testosterone because it's possible that drugs like thalidomide might have an effect at delaying testicular recovery, and there was really no difference between the two arms in terms of testosterone recovery. I think thalidomide and its newer counterpart, Revlimid or lenalidomide, are complex drugs. You referred to them as IMIDs. They have these kind of immunomodulatory properties. Thalidomide was originally approved for leprosy in this country. Many people will remember it because it led to all these birth defects in Europe about 30 years ago, really related probably to some inhibition of angiogenesis in the neonate. There's quite a lot of preclinical data that really started in Judah Folkman's lab and continued in Dr. Figg's lab at the NCI that suggests that thalidomide has potent anti-angiogenic properties. So before the advent of bevacizumab and sunitinib and some of these more targeted VEGF inhibitors, really the rationale here was that perhaps this drug was working as an angiogenesis inhibitor. We know that prostate cancers are very vascular. You can ask any urologist. These are very vascular tumors, and at least in preclinical models, microvessel density, other vascular factors are prognostic. So the rationale here was that if you inhibit angiogenesis with monotherapy with thalidomide, that you might, in this case, delay progression or induce responses in the tumors themselves.
What about bevacizumab, William, and also the tyrosine kinase inhibitors, sunitinib, sorafenib, that work inside the cell?
These are very interesting drugs, and as you know, in most solid tumors, they're actually combined with chemotherapy with the concept that they may actually help to deliver chemotherapy paradoxically better to the tumors because many tumors have kind of this disordered angiogenic property, and drugs like bevacizumab and sunitinib may actually improve blood flow to the tumors and therefore improve chemotherapy delivery. There's been a large randomized trial conducted by the CLGB that completed accrual last December comparing docetaxel plus placebo to docetaxel plus bevacizumab. So we should be hearing about that study probably in 2009. That's a survival benefit. And if that study's positive, then docetaxel plus bevacizumab could be the first-line treatment for metastatic castrate-resistant prostate cancer. Sunitinib has only so far been studied in phase 2 studies. And interestingly, drugs like this, we're noticing may have paradoxical effects on PSA. So, for example, there have been studies with SRAF and abansunitinib that suggest that perhaps you'll see a bone scan response, and yet the PSAs will actually go up. And we haven't quite figured that out, but it shows that we have to have caution with these newer biologics in terms of using traditional endpoints like PSA. That said, there is a planned phase 3 trial of sunitinib versus placebo in the post-chemotherapy setting. So monotherapy with sunitinib, which is a multi-targeted tyrosine kinase inhibitor. It's a pill. It targets VEGF, but it also targets other pathways like PDGF. And so it's believed that it may have enough activity as a single agent to lead to a survival benefit.
Anthony, where do you see this heading?
I think there will definitely be a role for biologics based on what the results of the ongoing randomized trials tell us. But if we just go back to a minute to the systems pathology thing we talked about earlier, given the toxicity of something, for example, like thalidomide, wouldn't it be nice if we were able to show in a tissue specimen up front that if this person expresses VEGF at some high level, that is, you know, vascular-related parameters, and his response to the thalidomide was based on that, then we would only give it to a person whose tissue expressed that, because in him, the risk-benefit ratio would be optimized because he would have the benefit even though he accepts the toxicity. The problem is when you accept toxicity and you don't get the benefit. So I think what we're going to do, the next step is we see the results of these randomized trials. If docetaxel plus bevacizumab is better than Taxotere alone, then maybe the next step is to do tissue expression studies on these patients up front to see, in fact, who actually benefited from the combination therapy, to try to target it in a more clinically meaningful way so as to give a person a benefit without having them have to suffer toxicity without benefit.
What about this paper in the JCO, William, from March, looking at this SWOG study of adjuvant chemotherapy and this, I guess, to me, sort of sad tale of that trial?
It is, I think, very important to remember what the risks of all of our treatments are. This is, of course, SWOG-9921, which is a large adjuvant trial randomizing high-risk patients after radical prostatectomy to 2 years of hormonal therapy with or without 6 cycles of mitoxantrone chemotherapy. When this study was conceived, mitoxantrone was the only chemotherapy drug that had any known activity in hormone-refractory or castrate-resistant prostate cancer, and it was chosen as the chemotherapy arm in this group. 3 patients out of 487 in that arm developed acute leukemia, actually AML, and in fact, at least 1 or 2 of them have died, although many of the patients were actually actively in treatment. And the reason it was published, and in fact, this subsequently led to the closure of the trial, was that, remember that even though we're talking about high-risk prostate cancer patients, we are talking about patients who are expected to live for a long time. Many of the prior abstracts showed this. So this is the way we get these kinds of answers. The way you get answers are to kind of understand in a prospective, well-done trial what the risk-benefit ratio is. This does not mean, I think, that necessarily that we won't use mitoxantrone in the future because, for example, if this turns out to be in the 980 patients who've been randomized so far to be a very potent adjuvant therapy that may reduce the risk of death from cancer, that those 3 leukemic deaths may turn out not to be important relative to the benefit. But on the other hand, it could be that more patients develop acute leukemia. So I think the key is that it reminds us that we have to put people on trials. We haven't had the same history as in breast or colorectal cancer of doing adjuvant trials, incorporating chemotherapy. I think that we have an open neoadjuvant study with docetaxel and hormonal therapy in high-risk patients, and we should be learning by putting patients on such randomized trials rather than just treating them outside of a clinical trial.
Now, I guess we should say that, I mean, this really wasn't a surprise. I mean, this has been seen before. You know, it's sort of an accepted part of the risk-benefit equation when anthracyclines have been used, certainly in breast cancer. And in fact, there's a lot less anthracyclines being used in breast cancer right now because of it. But were these numbers sort of out of the ballpark of what maybe you might have predicted 10 years ago?
I think it's a good question about what ultimately led them to stop the study if this is a known toxicity. And in fact, it was in the consent form for this trial because, again, these are known side effects. It really gets back to the other issue which they were discovering is that there were not a lot of events when these 3 leukemias occurred. So I think there was a serious concern about whether if they accrued to the total number that they originally had planned, that in order to see a survival benefit from mitoxantrone, that they would have had to expose a certain proportion more of patients to a potentially fatal disease, and that in their balance of these 2 issues, that this study would not have been successful, necessarily more successful by adding on another 200 or 300 patients.
We were talking about biologic therapy, and William, maybe you can take a shot at talking about this paper that was presented at the 2008 GU Symposium, first author Nancy Dawson, looking at the impact of a specific endothelin A receptor antagonist, ZD4054, and you can explain what that is. I actually met with Nancy and tried to get her to explain it to me, and I think I actually understood it. She's on our new audio program. Can you talk a little bit about what they reported here?
Sure. This was actually a randomized phase 2 trial, relatively sizable in terms of the number of patients who were accrued, but I just want to talk about the target. You know, endothelin A receptor is thought to be both present on prostate cancer cells and potentially on bone as well. And several years ago, many people may remember that there was actually another endothelin antagonist called atrasentan, which is still in clinical trials, which actually showed a benefit with regard to progression in a smaller trial, but it wasn't in a follow-up study. It wasn't confirmed, and it didn't have an overall survival benefit. And part of the issue with these class of drugs is, how are they working? Are they blocking cancer in the bone? Is that actually killing prostate cancer directly? And maybe there's a component of both. In any case, this is a novel endothelin receptor antagonist, and in a study of 312 patients, they randomized them internationally to receive one of two doses of this drug. It's an oral once-a-day medication versus a placebo, and their primary endpoint was, again, progression, but they did not allow PSA or bone mets to count as progression. So that may sound odd to people listening, because that's the way we treat these patients, but that was because they learned from the prior atrasentan study that this drug may actually delay cancer, even though the bone scan may actually look a little bit worse. And it sounds paradoxical to say something like this, but we know that bone scans are traditionally unreliable in that they may have radiographic flares associated with them that may not represent true cancer progression. So they made the decision not to use that, and they actually call progression clinical progression, using a new therapy like chemotherapy or radiation, increasing the amount of opiates or new soft tissue metastasis or death. So they were taking patients with early metastatic disease who were minimally symptomatic, and they gave them one of those three arms. And what was interesting was that there actually was no difference in progression-free survival, which was their primary endpoint. The hazard ratios were between the two doses 0.94 and 1.09 and crossed over 1. So there was no significant difference in their primary endpoint. But very interestingly, there was an improvement in both doses of ZD4054 with regard to overall survival compared to placebo. And these hazard ratios were quite strong, the 0.65 for the higher dose and 0.55 for the lower dose.
So a 35% reduction or 45% reduction in risk of death.
Right, with a p-value that was 0.008. So the other thing about these drugs is that they're oral once a day. The major side effect, when these class of drugs were first developed, they were actually developed as antihypertensives because this is a receptor that's known to be present on vasculature. So they get headaches and peripheral edema. They get allergic rhinitis, like a runny nose. So it's actually relatively well tolerated. So the fact that there was a suggestion, even though this wasn't the primary endpoint, but a suggestion of a strong survival benefit, and particularly in both doses, you like to see either a dose response or at least that the two doses are better than placebo, I think was certainly very intriguing.
Any thoughts, Anthony, about where this might be heading? And we're really getting used to seeing these kinds of data and, again, these biologic studies that we're seeing all across cancer. And it's so hard for a doc to look at numbers like this and decide, you know, and of course, obviously, it's not even available yet, but what it means. But improvement in survival, even though, you know, it's only, you know, a few months, is not something you see very often. It kind of struck me. What were your thoughts? Or do you think this thing, you know, you can't really comment about it at all at this point?
No, I can comment. This story here with this randomized phase 2 showing an unexpected increase in survival despite the fact that the primary endpoint wasn't reached. So another way of saying that is, if this survival benefit is validated in a future phase 3 study powered to look at survival, then our assessment of disease progression in the advanced state is inaccurate. And in fact, what it's really saying is that the mechanism of action of these drugs may be providing a survival benefit in a way that is not inferable or assessable by our standard diagnostic radiographic tools and, you know, assessment of pain and so forth. This is also reminiscent of the immunovaccine Provenge, which had the same exact story where you got an unexpected survival benefit but didn't achieve, you know, the primary endpoint, and that actually is the subject now of a phase 3 study. So I think at this juncture, what we can say is I look forward to the phase 3 study of this one as well as that immunovaccine. If, in fact, a survival benefit is documented, we need to rethink the way we're assessing response or progression, in people undergoing these types of agents in the advanced prostate cancer setting?
I do think that the issue of whether progression is an adequate endpoint for CRPC is a debate that's raging. We don't want to necessarily wait for overall survival for every single one of our clinical trials, especially since even for metastatic CRPC, the survival for these patients may be measured 2, 2.5, 3 years. So the question has become, can we get a surrogate endpoint that's faster? But I think studies like this, unfortunately, are showing us that with each biologic, potentially, with each new drug, we have to rethink whether our definitions of progression, whether they're PSA or bone scan or some clinical factor, is really an accurate depiction of the way the drug works and whether it's benefiting the patient. So I think Anthony really is absolutely right. The key question for each single drug is going to have to be determined differently when it comes to the issue of whether you can get an earlier endpoint. Survival, of course, we all recognize is the ultimate endpoint. And deep down in my heart, I want to understand how a drug keeps somebody alive if it doesn't prevent their cancers from progressing. But it may come down to the definition and the mechanism of action for each individual drug. It shows us that it's going to be really complex. We're not going to get some consensus group together where we're going to slap on, you know, 4 or 5 different definitions and everyone's going to say, yeah, this is fine. Because when we take a drug like sunitinib or bevacizumab, all bets may be off.
Just to be provocative, it's very possible that the mechanism of action could require progression as we currently define it to get response. For example, when you give an LHRH agonist, you get a testosterone surge before it gets suppressed. I'm just to give that as an analogy. It may very well be that we're not seeing it in terms of the progression-free survival, because maybe that's a necessary requirement to see response.
An excellent, interesting point. There's some old data with interferon in kidney cancer that suggested that the people who had the best survival benefit from interferon were not the ones who had no side effects from interferon, but who had some toxicity. They had fevers and achiness. But if they felt too bad, they also didn't benefit from it. So, you know, it's really getting to the concept of pharmacodynamics. Do the characteristics or the value of the drug, could they be related to the fact that patients are actually having some kind of response, like, say, on a bone scan that could be perceived as being negative?
Another set of papers I wanted to ask you about relates to abiraterone, which is the subject of a recent paper in the JCO and also several abstracts at ASCO and AUA.
This is a drug that inhibits an adrenal steroid, cytochrome P450 enzyme CYP17. The drug is called abiraterone acetate, and if people can't say it yet, they all read about it in the newspaper because this came out in a big way a few weeks ago. This is actually only a phase 1 study, believe it or not, only 21 patients in this trial, chemotherapy naive, resistant to other hormonal therapies, and were dose escalated on 5 different doses of once a day oral abiraterone. And the bottom line was that this drug was quite active. They saw PSA declines, which is a typical measure of activity in castrate-resistant prostate cancer. About 57% had at least a 50% or greater decline in PSA. There were also radiographic responses, clinical responses, reduction in analgesic use. So this is, I would say, very targeted therapy. Many people know and have used ketoconazole, which is completely untargeted, affects many enzymes in the adrenal pathway, steroid pathway. This is directed towards 2 lyases. This is that CYP17. 2 lyases that really lead to the generation of DHEA, androstenedione, and subsequently to testosterone and estradiol. You know, Huggins identified the adrenal as an important source of residual androgen, you know, 40, 50 years ago. We've always known that this is an important source after testicular ablation of persistent testosterone. And this drug really targets it and targets it quite effectively. They have some very nice data in this paper that suggests that the patient's median testosterone levels using a supersensitive assay, even though they were all castrated, was about 7. After they start abiraterone, they all go to undetectable levels, which in this assay was less than 1. These are very small amounts of testosterone. Not only that, DHEA, estradiol, androstenedione, they all go down and they stay down. And that may be the key to this, and it gets to really another underlying biology question that we talked about earlier, which is that the androgen pathway is probably still very important throughout the progression of prostate cancer. This is what this paper is really suggesting, is that what we used to call hormone refractory or androgen independent is not hormone refractory or androgen independent, but that really explains why we changed the terminology to CRPC. They're just castrate. They're still responding to drugs that block the adrenal steroid pathway and block testosterone production.
What about side effects and toxicities of this agent?
Yeah, the main side effect that they saw really was related to the upregulation of ACTH. So there was a feedback loop. When you block some enzymes, the adrenal gland says, you know, I need more ACTH, and it upregulated that, and that led to a higher level production of various mineralocorticoids. That led to high blood pressure and edema and some other unpleasant side effects. And you can use a mineralocorticoid antagonist, but actually something that really strongly suppresses that feedback loop is low-dose dexamethasone. So if you add a half a milligram of Decadron to this regimen, it basically suppresses that kind of escape mechanism and suppresses ACTH. So the phase 3 studies going forward will actually use abiraterone acetate with low-dose Decadron.
So what's the projection in terms of the earliest that this agent might be available?
Well, a very large randomized international trial is actually ongoing right now. My guess is that with all of the positive press that this actual phase 1 study being published has generated, that it will accrue extremely rapidly. And my guess would be that we would actually have survival data somewhere at the end of next year, maybe in early 2010, but possibly as soon as next year, we'll actually know whether this drug improves survival. I should point out that this study is being done in patients who have received prior chemotherapy. So this phase 1 study was pre-chemo, but they have phase 2 data in post-chemo patients that suggests that the activity is not any different. And that doesn't actually surprise me. In fact, you know, the idea that patients who get chemotherapy may not respond to hormones and vice versa may be simplistic in terms of understanding hormone resistance. So they're doing that for a couple of reasons. One is that that's an easier place in order to study a drug like this, because then all of the patients will have received docetaxel, which is approved in this setting. And the other is that because their outcome is survival, they'll have a faster time to the endpoint.
Peter, what's your take on this paper, this agent, and maybe other approaches to endocrine therapy that are being tested?
Well, in my mind, this was the most interesting agent discussed at ASCO, and it was remarkable to me that even patients who may have failed ketoconazole responded to this agent.
That's right.
Which I found interesting and remarkable. So I'm actually kind of excited about this agent and look forward to the results of the larger phase 3 trial.
What about other strategies, William, that target the androgen receptor or other hormonal manipulations?
Well, there is an interesting compound called MDV-3100 that was developed really out of Charles Sawyer's lab when he was at UCLA and then subsequently at Memorial, which is really a better anti-androgen. It probably degrades the actual androgen receptor. And in preclinical studies, it works even in patients who fail traditional anti-androgen therapies like bicalutamide or flutamide. And in the clinic so far, at almost every dose level it's been tested, there have been signs of responses. So that's generating quite a lot of excitement. There was an interesting study done by one of my colleagues at the Dana-Farber multicenter trial done through the DoD Prostate Cancer Consortium of ketoconazole with hydrocortisone, which is a traditional adrenal steroid inhibitor. But what was done was dutasteride was added to that regimen, the so-called CAD, K-H-A-D regimen. And the paper was presented at ASCO this year, and it suggested a very promising delay in progression with the addition of dutasteride. So I'd encourage people to look at that abstract and think about that, pending the availability of abiraterone, which may still take a year or longer, that there may be ways of taking traditional drugs out there and trying to make them work a little bit better.
So the last paper I want to ask you about, William, is the paper published in JAMA looking at primary androgen deprivation therapy among men with localized prostate cancer.
Yeah, so this was an interesting analysis of the SEER registry linked to Medicare. So 19,000 men were looked at who had localized prostate cancer, T1 or T2, but did not receive any local therapy like surgery or radiation. And of those, surprisingly to me, about 41% actually received primary androgen deprivation therapy as their only treatment. The other 60% or so had a more expectant management, watchful waiting. And what was interesting about the study, and it got a lot of attention for this, was that unlike what might have been expected by an average clinician, the patients who actually received primary androgen deprivation therapy did a little bit worse. If you looked at 10-year prostate cancer-specific survival, the hazard ratio for survival was better in the group that did not receive any androgen deprivation. At 10 years, it was 80% versus 82.6%. And overall survival, there was no difference. It really suggested that at least in the average patient with a newly diagnosed prostate cancer, if you're not thinking of doing surgery or radiation, that starting them on hormonal therapy doesn't necessarily improve their outcome. And in fact, if anything, might be associated with a slightly worse outcome. They did do a subset analysis in patients with more poorly differentiated cancers. And in that group, the prostate cancer specific survival was a little bit better, but overall survival was not different. So again, I think the lesson for me here is, A, you know, it's surprising to me how many patients with localized prostate cancer actually do not wind up getting any form of local therapy. But of those that choose not to get surgery or radiation and are monitored up to 40% of them are actually treated with hormonal therapy alone. And given what we talked about earlier about all the risks of hormonal therapy, and given this data that suggests that hormonal therapy may actually be worse for some of these patients and certainly is not associated with any primary benefit in terms of overall survival, it really makes one very cautious to consider taking an asymptomatic patient without metastatic disease and starting them on hormones.
Peter, what was your take on this data and how it compares to work that you've done with CAPTURE?
Well, CAPTURE also underscores the high penetrance of the use of hormonal therapy, even in low-risk patients. So I agree completely with William. You have to rethink this paradigm, and in low-risk patients who may not benefit from hormonal therapy, just consider that they can be harmed.
But isn't there a methodology issue here? Wouldn't you expect that maybe the people who got hormone therapy for some reason, you know, maybe been thought to have a worse prognosis?
I think without question, anytime you use data like this, it's population-based data like SEER, it's not very well annotated. So you have very little information about other features which are predictive. And that's why I think when they were able to show a little higher risk cohort, you may see a benefit. But again, even I think in a well-annotated study, you will find out that in low-risk patients, there's no advantage to using hormonal therapy and there may be harm, whereas in high-risk patients, there may be benefit.